How much can you love? As Cynthia worked on her parents, Louis went into wedding overdrive. He tracked down reception sites, invitations, a caterer, and a jeweler. He found the Church of Our Savior, which Cynthia had attended as a child. He bought a used Chevy convertible and overhauled it to impress Cynthia. Trying to make a new man of himself, he quit drinking and smoking. He took terminal leave from the Air Force, meaning that he formally ended active duty, but would still wear his uniform and draw pay until his accumulated leave ran out in August, at which point he'd become a captain in the Air Force Reserve. He began a low-paying job at the Warner Brothers Studios, teaching actors how to ride horses. What he didn't have was a proper place to live. Because Los Angeles was teeming with repatriated soldiers, inexpensive housing was all but impossible to find. So, Louis was still living with his parents. Cynthia wrote of how badly she wanted a home of her own. But Louis, in some distress, wrote back to explain that he didn't have the money. The best he could do was to move into the house that Harry Reid shared with his mother and promise Cynthia that he'd do whatever he could to earn enough money for a home. He bought an air mattress for Cynthia. He'd sleep on the floor. After POW camp, he said, he didn't mind sleeping on floors. The Applewhites' opposition to the marriage, the pressure to make a good life for Cynthia, and his black memories left Louis taut with stress. He had little appetite. He was emerging from years in which the only constants were violence and loss, and his letters show how much he feared something terrible befalling Cynthia. He clung to the thought of her, as if, at any moment, she might be torn from his hands. He was especially worried about her parents' views of him. He felt certain that they objected to him personally, finding his Italian ethnicity and middle-class origins repellent. He wrote earnest letters to her father, trying to win him over. When he kept seeing the same car parked by the Reed's house, he became convinced that it was a detective hired by Cynthia's father. According to Cynthia's brother, Rick, his parents had no objection to Louis, only to a hasty marriage. As for the spying, Rick said, such an act would be unlike his easygoing father, and would have made no sense, as Mr. Applewhite liked Louis. Right or wrong, Louis's suspicions illustrated how sensitive he was to the idea that he was unworthy of Cynthia. Perhaps it wasn't the Applewhites he was trying to convince. 6 months after returning from Japan, Louis began to feel a familiar pull. It had just been announced that the Summer Olympic Games, which hadn't been held since 1936, were set to return. They'd be held in London in July 1948. Louis's bad leg felt passably sound, and he finally felt healthy. He began testing himself with long hikes, borrowing a dog for company. The leg felt sturdy, the body strong. July of 48 was more than 2 years away. Louis began training. In May, Cynthia and her parents made a deal. Cynthia could visit Louis on the condition that they not marry until the fall, in a ceremony at the Applewhite Mansion. Cynthia threw her clothes into a suitcase and went to the airport. As she left, her brother Rick felt a pang of worry. He was afraid that his young sister, dashing off to be with a man she hardly knew, might be making an enormous mistake. At Burbank Airport, on May 17th, the plane stopped on the tarmac. The stairway unfolded, and Louis bounded up the steps to embrace Cynthia, then squired her home to meet his family. The Zamperinis fell for her, just as Louis had. Driving away after the visit, Louis sensed that Cynthia was drawing backward. Maybe during the visit there had been a word or a look that hinted at all she didn't know. Or maybe impulsive decisions made in the fog of lovesickness were becoming real. Whatever it was, Louis thought he was losing her. He lost his temper and abruptly said that maybe they should call off the engagement. Cynthia panicked, and they argued, overwrought. When they calmed down, they made a decision. On Saturday, May 25th, the same day that the papers quoted Louis as saying he'd marry Cynthia at the summer's end, Louis and Cynthia drove to the Church of Our Savior, where the Zamperinis were waiting. He wore his dress uniform. She wore a simple off-white suit. One of Louis's college buddies walked Cynthia down the aisle, and Louis and Cynthia said their vows. There had been no time to bake a wedding cake, so Pete's birthday cake, made by Sylvia the day before, did double duty. Suspecting that Louis's friends would pull wedding night pranks, the newlyweds stole off to an obscure hotel, and Cynthia called home. Her announcement prompted an explosion. Cynthia hung on the phone all evening, crying, while her mother, who'd gone to great effort to plan a fall wedding, bawled her out. Louis sat by, listening as his bride was excoriated for marrying him, trying in vain to get her to hang up. Eventually, he picked up a bottle of champagne, popped it open, drank it dry, and went to sleep by himself. Chapter 35. Coming Undone. From across the room, they looked like three ordinary men. It was an evening in the latter half of 1946, and Louis sat at a table in the Florentine Gardens, a dinner club in Hollywood, with Cynthia nestled near him. Phil and Cece had come from Indiana for a visit, and Fred Garrett had motored across town to join them for dinner. Phil and Louis were grinning at each other. The last time they'd been together was March of 44, when Phil was being shipped out of Ofuna, and neither man knew if he'd live to see the other again. The men smiled and talked. Fred, who was soon to become an air traffic controller, had a new prosthetic leg. In a festive mood, he bumped out to the dance floor to show the room that he could still cut a rug. Phil and Cece were about to move to New Mexico, where Phil would open a plastics business. Louis and Cynthia were glowing from their honeymoon, spent sharing a sleeping bag in Louis's beloved mountains, where Cynthia, for all her finishing schools, had proven game for getting dirty. Louis was running again, full of big plans, as garrulous and breezy as he'd been before the war. As the men leaned together for photographs, all that they had been through seemed forgotten. Sometime amid the laughing and conversation, a waiter set a plate in front of Fred. On it, beside the entree, was a serving of white rice. That was all it took. Fred was suddenly raving, furious, hysterical, berating the waiter and shouting with such force that his face turned purple. Louis tried to calm him, but Fred was beyond consolation. He had come completely undone. The waiter hurried the rice away and Fred pulled himself together, but the spell was broken. For these men, nothing was ever going to be the same. At the end of World War II, thousands of former prisoners of the Japanese, known as Pacific POWs, began their post-war lives. Physically, almost every one of them was ravaged. The average Army or Army Air Force's Pacific POW had lost 61 pounds in captivity, a remarkable statistic, given that roughly three-quarters of the men had weighed just 159 pounds or less upon enlistment. Tuberculosis, malaria, dysentery, malnutrition, anemia, eye ailments, and festering wounds were widespread. At one chain of hospitals, doctors found a history of wet beriberi in 77% of POWs and dry beriberi in half. Among Canadian POWs, 84% had neurologic damage. Respiratory diseases from infections and exposure to unbreathable air in factories and mines were rampant. Men had been crippled and disfigured by unset broken bones, and their teeth had been ruined by beatings and years of chewing grit in their food. Others had gone blind from malnutrition. Scores of men were so ill that they had to be carried from camps, and it was common for men to remain hospitalized for many months after repatriation. Some couldn't be saved. The physical injuries were lasting, debilitating, and sometimes deadly. A 1954 study found that in the first two post-war years, former Pacific POWs died at almost four times the expected rate for men of their age, and continued to die at unusually high rates for many years. The health repercussions often lasted for decades. A follow-up study found that 22 years after the war, former Pacific POWs had hospitalization rates between 2 and 8 times higher than former European POWs for a host of diseases. As bad as were the physical consequences of captivity, the emotional injuries were much more insidious, widespread, and enduring. In the first 6 post-war years, one of the most common diagnoses given to hospitalized former Pacific POWs was psychoneurosis. Nearly 40 years after the war, more than 85% of former Pacific POWs in one study suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, characterized in part by flashbacks, anxiety, and nightmares. And in a 1987 study, 8 in 10 former Pacific POWs had psychiatric impairment. 6 in 10 had anxiety disorders, more than 1 in 4 had PTSD, and nearly 1 in 5 was depressed. For some, there was only one way out. A 1970 study reported that former Pacific POWs committed suicide 30% more often than controls. All of this illness, physical and emotional, took a shocking toll. Veterans were awarded compensation based on their level of disability, ranging from 10% to 100%. As of January 1953, one-third of former Pacific POWs were categorized as 50 to 100% disabled, nearly 8 years after the war's end. These statistics translated into tormented and sometimes ruined lives. Flashbacks in which men re-experienced their traumas and were unable to distinguish the illusion from reality were common. Intense nightmares were almost ubiquitous. Men walked in their sleep, acting out prison camp ordeals, and woke screaming, sobbing, or lashing out. Some slept on their floors because they couldn't sleep on mattresses, ducked in terror when airliners flew over, or hoarded food. One man had a recurrent hallucination of seeing his dead POW friends walking past. Another was unable to remember the war. Milton McMullen couldn't stop using Japanese terms, a habit that had been pounded into him. Dr. Alfred Weinstein, who had infected the bird with dysentery at Mitsushima, was dogged by urges to scavenge in garbage cans. Huge numbers of men escaped by drinking. In one study of former Pacific POWs, more than a quarter had been diagnosed with alcoholism. Raymond Happ Halloran was a navigator who parachuted into Tokyo after his B-29 was shot down. Once on the ground, Halloran was beaten by a mob of civilians, then captured by Japanese authorities who tortured him, locked him in a pig cage, and held him in a burning horse stall during the firebombings. They stripped him naked and put him on display at Tokyo's Ueno Zoo, tied upright in an empty tiger cage, so civilians could gawk at his filthy, sore-encrusted body. He was starved so severely that he lost 100 pounds. After liberation and 8 months in a hospital, Halloran went home to Cincinnati. I was not the same 19-year-old Raymond whose mother kissed him goodbye that fall morning in 1942, he wrote. He was intensely nervous and wary of anything approaching him from behind. He couldn't sleep with his arms covered, fearing that he'd need to fight off attackers. He had horrific nightmares and would wake running in his yard shouting for help. He avoided hotels because his screaming upset other guests. More than 60 years after the war, he was still plagued by poor inventory control, keeping 8 pillows and 6 clocks in his bedroom, buying far more clothes and supplies than he'd ever need, and stockpiling bulk packages of food. And yet, Halloran was fortunate. Of the 5 survivors of his crew, 2 drank themselves to death. Some former POWs became almost feral with rage. For many men, seeing an Asian person or overhearing a snippet of Japanese left them shaking, weeping, enraged, or lost in flashbacks. One former POW, normally gentle and quiet, spat at every Asian person he saw. At Letterman General Hospital just after the war, 4 former POWs tried to attack a staffer who was of Japanese ancestry, not knowing that he was an American veteran. Troubled former POWs found nowhere to turn. McMullen came out of Japan racked by nightmares and so nervous that he was barely able to speak cogently. When he told his story to his family, his father accused him of lying and forbade him to speak of the war. Shattered and deeply depressed, McMullen couldn't eat, and his weight plunged back down to 90 pounds. He went to a veterans hospital, but the doctor simply gave him B-12 shots. As he recounted his experiences to a military official, the official picked up a phone and began talking with someone else. After 2 years, McMullen got his feet under him again, but he would never really recover. 60 years after VJ Day, his dreams still carried him back to the camps. Recounting his war experiences was so painful that it would leave him off-kilter for weeks. The Pacific POWs who went home in 1945 were torn-down men. They had an intimate understanding of man's vast capacity to experience suffering, as well as his equally vast capacity and hungry willingness to inflict it. They carried unspeakable memories of torture and humiliation, and an acute sense of vulnerability that attended the knowledge of how readily they could be disarmed and dehumanized. Many felt lonely and isolated, having endured abuses that ordinary people couldn't understand. Their dignity had been obliterated, replaced with a pervasive sense of shame and worthlessness, and they had the caustic knowledge that no one had come between them and tragedy. Coming home was an experience of profound, perilous aloneness. For these men, the central struggle of post-war life was to restore their dignity and find a way to see the world as something other than menacing blackness. There was no one right way to peace. Every man had to find his own path according to his own history. Some succeeded. For others, the war would never really end. Some retreated into brooding isolation or lost themselves in escapes. And for some men, years of swallowed rage, terror, and humiliation concentrated into what Holocaust survivor Jean Améry would call a seething, purifying thirst for revenge. The honeymoon in the mountains had been Cynthia's idea. Louis loved her for being so sporting and for choosing something so dear to his heart. "You must look about you and remember what the trees and hills, streams and lakes look like," he wrote to her before their wedding. "I will see you among them for life." Drifting off beside Cynthia each night, Louis still saw the bird lurking in his dreams. But the sergeant hung back as if cowed, or perhaps just waiting. It was the closest thing to peace that Louis had known since Green Hornet had hit the water. The drive back to Los Angeles carried them from the great wide open to the confines of Harry Reid's mother's house. Cynthia was uncomfortable living there, and Louis wanted to give her the home she dreamed of. He needed to find a career, but was unprepared to do so. Having left USC a few credits short, he had no college degree, a critical asset in a job market glutted with veterans and former war production workers. Like many elite athletes, he had focused on his sport throughout his school years and had never seriously contemplated life after running. Now, nearly 30, he had no idea what to do for a living. He made no effort to find a real career or a 9-to-5 salary job. His celebrity drew people into his orbit, many of them hawking ventures in which he could invest his life insurance payoff, which he'd been allowed to keep. He went to military surplus sales, bought Quonset huts, and resold them to movie studios. He did the same with ice boxes, then invested in a telephone technology. He turned respectable profits, but each investment quickly ran its course. He did, however, earn a steady enough income to rent an apartment for himself and Cynthia. It was only a tiny place in a low-rent quarter of Hollywood, but Cynthia did her best to make it homey. At the end of his first day in the new apartment, Louis slid into bed, closed his eyes, and fell into a dream. As always, the bird was there, but he was no longer hesitant. The sergeant towered over Louis, the belt flicking from his hand, lashing Louis's face. Every night he returned, and Louis was helpless once again, unable to flee him or drive him away. Louis threw himself into training. His long hikes became runs. His strength was coming back, and his dodgy leg gave him no pain. He took it slowly, thinking always of London in 48. He was aiming for the 1,500 meters and assured himself that if he couldn't make it, he'd return to the 5,000 or even the steeplechase. But without extending himself, he began clocking miles in 4 minutes 18 seconds, just 2 seconds slower than the winning time of the Zamperini Invitational that he'd seen in March. He was coming all the way back. But running wasn't the same. Once he had felt liberated by it. Now it felt forced. Running was joyless. But Louis had no other answer to his internal turmoil. He doubled his workouts, and his body answered. One day, with Cynthia standing by, holding a stopwatch, Louis set off to see how fast he could turn 2 miles. Early on, he felt a pulse of pain dart across his left ankle, just where it had been injured, at Nawetsu. He knew better than to keep pushing, but pushing was all he knew now. As he completed the first mile, barbs of pain were crackling through his ankle. On he went, running for London. Late in his last lap, there was an abrupt slicing sensation in his ankle. He half-hopped to the line and collapsed. His time was the fastest 2 mile run on the Pacific coast in 1946, but it didn't matter. He was unable to walk for a week and would limp for weeks more. A doctor confirmed that he had disastrously exacerbated his war injury. It was all over. Louis was wrecked. The quest that had saved him as a kid was lost to him. The last barricade within him fell. By day, he couldn't stop thinking about the bird. By night, the sergeant lashed him, hungry and feral. As the belt whipped him, Louis would fight his way to his attacker's throat and close his hands around it. No matter how hard he squeezed, those eyes still danced at him. Louis regularly woke screaming and soaked in sweat. He was afraid to sleep. He started smoking again. There seemed no reason not to drink, so each evening he swigged wine as he cooked, leaving Cynthia sitting through dinner with a tipsy husband. Invitations to clubs kept coming, and now it seemed harmless to accept the free drinks that were always offered. At first he drank just beer, then he dipped into hard liquor. If he got drunk enough, he could drown the war for a time. He soon began drinking so much that he passed out, but he welcomed it. Passing out saved him from having to go to bed and wait for his monster. Unable to talk him into giving it up, Cynthia stopped going out with him. He left her alone each night while he went out to lose the war. Rage, wild, random, and impossible to quell, began to consume him. Once he harassed a man for walking too slowly on a crosswalk in front of his car, and the man spat at him. Louis gunned the car to the curb, jumped out, and as Cynthia screamed for him to stop, punched the man until he fell to the ground. On another day, when a man at a bar accidentally let a door swing into him, Louis chested up to him and provoked an embarrassing little scuffle that ended with Louis grinding the man's face in the dirt. His mind began to derail. While sitting at a bar, he heard a sudden loud sound, perhaps a car backfiring. Before he knew it, he was on the floor, cringing, as the bar fell silent and the patrons stared. On another night, he was drinking, his mind drifting, when someone nearby yelled something while joking with friends. In Louis's mind, it was, "Kyrie!" He found himself jumping up, back straight, head up, heart pounding, awaiting the flying belt buckle. In a moment, the illusion cleared, and he saw that, again, everyone in the bar was looking at him. He felt foolish and humiliated. One day, Louis was overcome by a strange, inexplicable feeling, and suddenly the war was all around and in him, not a memory, but the actual experience. The glaring and grating and stench and howl and terror of it. In a moment he was jerked back out again, confused and frightened. It was his first flashback. After that, if he caught a glimpse of blood or saw a tussle in a bar, everything would reassemble itself as prison camp, and the mood, the light, the sounds, his own body, would all be as they were, inescapable. In random moments, he felt lice and fleas wriggling over his skin, when there was nothing there. It only made him drink harder. Cynthia urged Louis to get help. So he went, reluctantly, to see a counselor at a veterans hospital. He spoke of the war and the nightmares and came home feeling as turbulent as when he'd left. After two or three sessions, he quit. One day he opened a newspaper and saw a story that riveted his attention. A former Pacific POW had walked into a store and seen one of his wartime captors. The POW had called the police, who'd arrested the alleged war criminal. As Louis read the story, all of the fury within him converged. He saw himself finding the bird, overpowering him, his fists bloodying the face, and then his hands locking about the bird's neck. In his fantasy, he killed the bird slowly, savoring the suffering he caused, making his tormentor feel all of the pain and terror and helplessness that he'd felt. His veins beat with an electric urgency. Louis had no idea what had become of the bird, but he felt sure that if he could get back to Japan, he could hunt him down. This would be his emphatic reply to the bird's unremitting effort to extinguish his humanity. "I am still a man." He could conceive of no other way to save himself. Louis had found a quest to replace his lost Olympics. He was going to kill the bird. Chapter 36. The Body on the Mountain. It was the first winter after the war. An aged police officer trudged through a village high in the mountains of Japan's Nagano Prefecture, knocking on doors, asking questions, and moving on. The Ministry of Home Affairs, frustrated at the failure to track down Mutsuhiro Watanabe, was renewing its effort, sending out photographs of and reports on the fugitive to every police chief in Japan. Chiefs were under orders to report twice a month on their progress. Police officers conducted searches and interrogations nearly every day. In one prefecture alone, 9,100 officers were involved in the search for him. The officer in Nagano was part of this effort. It was around noon when he reached the largest house in the village, home to a farmer and his family. Someone answered the door, and the family, thinking that he was a census taker, invited him in. Inside, the policeman found an old, portly farmer, the farmer's wife, and their live-in laborer. As the laborer prepared a plate of pickles and a cup of tea, a traditional offering to visitors, the officer pulled out a photograph of Watanabe, dressed in his sergeant's uniform. Did they recognize the man? None of them did. The officer left, moving on to a neighbor. He had no idea that the fugitive he was seeking had just been standing right in front of him, holding a plate of pickles. The bird had come to Nagano Prefecture the previous September, after having fled his brother's home, then Kofu. Reaching the hot springs resort community of Manza Spa, he checked into an inn. He chose an alias, Saburo Ota, a common name unlikely to attract notice or dwell in anyone's memory. He had a mustache, which he'd begun growing in the last days of the war. He told people that he was a refugee from Tokyo, whose relatives were all dead, a story that in post-war Japan was as common as white rice. He vowed to live by two imperatives, silence and patience. Manza was a good choice, trafficked by crowds in which Watanabe could lose himself. But he soon began to think that he'd be better hidden in the prefecture's remote mountain regions. He met the old farmer and offered himself as a laborer in exchange for room and board. The farmer took him to his home in the rural village, and Watanabe settled in as a farmhand. Each night, lying on a straw mat on the farmer's floor, Watanabe couldn't sleep. All over Japan, war crime suspects had been captured and were now imprisoned, awaiting trials. He'd known some of these men. They'd be tried, sentenced, some executed. He was free. On the pages on which he poured out his emotions about his plight, Watanabe wrote of feeling guilty when he thought of those soldiers. He also mulled over his behavior toward the POWs, describing himself as powerful and strict when requesting POWs to obey the rules. "Am I guilty?" he wrote. He didn't answer his question, but he also expressed no remorse. Even as he wrote of his gratitude for the humanity of the farmer who had taken him in, he couldn't see the parallel with himself and the helpless men who had fallen into his hands. The radio in the farmer's house was often on, and each day Watanabe listened to reports on fugitive war crimes suspects. He scanned the faces of his hosts as the stories aired, worried that they'd suspect him. The newspapers, too, were full of articles on these fugitives, described as enemies of human beings. The pronouncements wounded Watanabe's feelings. It seemed to him outrageous that the Allies, who would not forgive, would oversee trials of Japanese. God alone, he felt, was qualified to judge him. "I wanted to cry out," he wrote, "that's not fair." The tension of living incognito wore on him. He was especially wary of the farmer's wife, whose gaze seemed to convey suspicion. Sleep came so reluctantly that he had to work himself to exhaustion to bring it on. He brooded on the question of whether or not he should surrender. One night, as the evening's fire died in the hearth, Watanabe came to the farmer and told him who he was. The farmer listened, his eyes fixed on the fire, his tongue clicking against his false teeth. "People say to control your mouth, or it brings evil," the farmer said. "You should be careful of your speech." He said nothing else and turned away. As the bird hid, other men who had abused POWs were arrested, taken to Sugamo Prison in Tokyo, and tried for war crimes. Roughly 5,400 Japanese were tried by the United States and other nations. Some 4,400 were convicted, including 984 given death sentences and 475 given life in prison. More than 30 Ofuna personnel were convicted and sentenced to a total of roughly 350 years in prison. The thieving cook, Tatsumi Curly Hata, was sentenced to 20 years. Masajiro Shithead Hiriyabashi, who'd beaten countless prisoners and killed Gaga the Duck, was given 4 years. Commander Kakuzo Iida, the mummy, was sentenced to death for contributing to the deaths of 5 captives. Also convicted was Sueharu Kitamura, the quack, who had mutilated his patients, bludgeoned Harris, and contributed to the deaths of 4 captives, including one who was carried from Ofuna at the war's end, hours from death, crying out "quack" over and over again. Kitamura was sentenced to hang. Kaname Sakaba, the Omori commander, was given a life sentence. Of the men from Naoetsu, 6 civilian guards were tried, convicted, and hanged. 7 Japanese soldiers were also convicted, Two were hanged, four given life imprisonment with hard labor, and one given 20 years. The police found Jimmy Sasaki working as a liaison between the Japanese Navy and the occupying forces. Ever a fabulist, he told investigators that Ofuna interrogators were always kind to prisoners, that he'd never seen a prisoner abused, and that prisoners rarely complained. In questioning, the truth about his position at Ofuna finally emerged. He had not been the chief interrogator, bearing a rank equal to admiral that he had claimed to be. He'd been only a low-ranking interpreter. This man, of ever-shifting allegiances, tried to shift them again, speaking of his debt to America, and asking if someone could get him a job with the U.S. Army. Instead of a job, he received an indictment, charged with ordering the abuse of several captives, including one who'd been starved and tortured to death. Though the trial testimony seemed to raise enormous doubt as to his guilt, Sasaki was convicted and ultimately sentenced to 6 years of hard labor. And so the strange and twisting war journey of Louis's one-time friend ended in Sugamo Prison, where he was a model prisoner, tending a vegetable garden and a grove of trees. Who Jimmy Sasaki really was, whether artful spy and willing instrument in Japan's machine of violence, or something more innocent, remains a mystery. Of the post-war stories of the men who ran the camps in which Louis had lived, the saddest was that of Yukichi Kano, the Omori private who'd risked everything to protect the POWs and had probably saved several prisoners' lives. Just after the war's end was announced, Kano came upon a group of drunken guards stumbling toward the barracks, swords drawn, determined to hack some captured B-29 men to death. Kano and another man planted themselves in the guards' path and, after a brief scuffle, stopped them. Kano was a hero. But when the Americans came to liberate the camp, two of them tried to rip the insignia off his uniform. Bob Martindale stepped in and gave the Americans a furious dressing down. Fearing that Kano might be mistakenly accused of war crimes, Martindale and several other POW officers wrote a letter of commendation for him before they went home. It did no good. Kano was arrested and jailed as a suspected war criminal. Why he was fingered remains unclear. He was mentioned in many POW affidavits, and in every one of them was lauded for his kindness. Perhaps the explanation was that his last name was similar to those of two vicious men, Tetsutaro Kato, an Omori official said to have kicked a POW nearly to death, and Hiroaki Kono, the bird's acolyte at Naoetsu. Months passed, and Kano languished in prison, frightened and humiliated. He was neither charged nor questioned. He wrote a plaintive letter asking authorities to investigate him so his name could be cleared. "Cross my heart," he wrote, "I have not done anything wrong." In the winter of 1946, Kano was finally cleared, and MacArthur ordered his release. Kano moved to Yokohama and worked for an import-export business. He missed his POW friends, but for years he didn't try to contact them. "I thought I should refrain from writing them," he wrote to Martindale in 1955, "as my letter might make them to remind up the hard days in Omori, which I'm sure they would like to forget." Sometime later, he died of cancer. In the mountain village where he was known as Saburo Ota, Watanabe waited out a bitter winter. The visit from the policeman shook him. After the policeman left, the farmer's wife eyed Watanabe with what seemed to be recognition. When night fell, Watanabe lay awake, mulling capture and execution. When summer came, Watanabe was asked to attend the farmer's son as he toured the country selling leather straps. The tour would take them through major cities, where Watanabe was surely being sought, but he was living on the good graces of the farmer and had to accept. Watanabe donned glasses to obscure his features and headed off, filled with trepidation. They went to the busy port cities of Akita and Niigata. No one gave Watanabe a second look. As his fear of being discovered eased, he began enjoying himself. The conversation in the cities was dominated by the war, and everyone had an opinion about the conduct of Japanese soldiers, especially those accused of war crimes. People talked of how the hunt for suspected war criminals was being conducted. Watanabe listened intently. Being out in society made him long to see his family. He thought of how his mother would now be in Tokyo on her regular summer visit to his sister Michiko's home. The yearning was overpowering. Watanabe took out the fortune-telling cards that his little sister had given him and dealt himself a hand. The cards told him that if he went to his family, he'd be safe. On a sweltering day at the height of the summer of 1946, he boarded a train for Tokyo. His timing couldn't have been worse. The winter's push to find Watanabe had yielded no clues, and the police were again doubling their efforts. A newly discovered photograph of Watanabe had been copied and distributed, along with a report that described him as a man known to have perversions, who might be found wherever there are loose women. Since Japanese citizens were required to register changes of address, police were ordered to pore over registries in search of men traveling alone. They were instructed to monitor transactions at ration boards and prowl post offices, train and bus stations, taxi stands, ferry landings, mines, black market outlets, dive hotels and lodging houses, and any businesses that might attract a man fluent in French. Probably inspired by the clue that Watanabe might have committed suicide, police moved to investigate all unnatural and unusual deaths since November 1945, especially those in which the deceased person was unidentified. As a homesick Watanabe journeyed out of hiding and into Tokyo, he was walking into the manhunt. Shizuka Watanabe was sitting in Michiko's house with two of her other children when the front door swung open and in walked Mutsuhiro. The room fell silent as the startled family members looked at Mutsuhiro and then at one another. Mutsuhiro, emotionally overwhelmed and dizzy from the midday heat, wavered, afraid he would faint. Michiko came in and saw her brother. The family broke into celebration. For 2 hours, Mutsuhiro sat with his family, sipping drinks and listening to them tell of being arrested, questioned, followed, and searched. He said nothing of where he'd been, believing that his family would fare better if they didn't know. As time passed, the family members grew anxious, afraid that the detectives would catch them. They'd been there just 2 days previously. At 2 o'clock, Shizuka warned Mutsuhiro that it was the time of day when the detectives usually came to search. Mutsuhiro reassured them that the playing cards had told him that all would be well. There was a shuffling outside. The detectives had arrived. The Watanabe sprang up. Someone tossed Mutsuhiro's belongings into a closet. Someone else snatched up the cups and dumped them in the sink. Mutsuhiro raced into a tea room and shut the door. Behind him, he heard footfalls as a group of detectives entered the room that he had just left. He heard them questioning his mother and sister, telling them that if they caught Mutsuhiro, he'd be treated well. The detectives were just feet away, on the other side of the door. His heart racing, Mutsuhiro tried to decide whether to run or to conceal himself here. The room was tiny, scattered with pillows, but there was a closet. Ever so slowly, he inched open the closet's sliding door and squeezed inside. He decided not to close the door, fearing that it would make noise. He stood there, a hand clasped over his mouth to smother the sound of his breathing. The door opened. A detective looked in. "You have plenty of room," he said to the family. There was a pause as he looked about. If the detective turned his eyes toward the closet, he'd see Mutsuhiro. "It is tidy," the detective said. The door closed. The detectives left. Mutsuhiro had wished to stay overnight, but the close call changed his mind. He told his mother that he'd try to see her again in 2 years. Then he left. Walking back, he wrote, "Into the lonesome world." Watanabe returned to the village. The farmer's son, unable to make a go of his leather strap sales, opened a coffee shop in the village. Watanabe became his waiter. The farmer approached Watanabe with a proposition. Arranged marriage was still common in Japan, and the farmer had found a match for him. Watanabe was tempted. He was lonely and unhappy, and liked the idea of marrying. But marriage, while in his predicament, seemed impossible. He said no. The young woman eventually came to him. When the farmer's son fell ill, she paid him a visit, and Watanabe, curious, went into the sick room to see her. He raised the subject of the novel that the farmer's son was reading, thinking that, he wrote, if she liked books, she must understand the mind and hardship of human life. In his notes about the meeting, he didn't say if she possessed that understanding, but he did seem to like her and thought she would be a good housekeeper. Part of him seemed to want to fall for her, and he believed that love could save my daily life. The woman was taken with the attractive waiter and began lingering in the coffee shop to be near him. He kept his identity secret from her. She began telling her parents about him in hopes of winning their blessing for a wedding. After brooding on her, Watanabe decided that he had to end the relationship. All he told her was that he had a burden which would make her unhappy. With that, he broke with the tenuous existence that he had created in the village. He quit his job and left. He wandered onto a stretch of the Nagano grassland along the Chikuma River and took a job as a cowherd. His inability to control the willful animals exasperated him. He was despondent. At sunset, he lifted his eyes to the majestic Asama volcano, watching a ribbon of smoke unspooling from her upper reaches, the cattle grazing below. In Japan's Okuchichibu Mountains stands the holy peak of Mitsumine, its sides fleeced in forest, its summit ornamented with an ancient shrine. In the fall of 1946, two bodies were found amid the hollows and spines of the mountain, a pistol lying with them. One was a man, the other a woman. No one knew who they were. The police went to Shizuka Watanabe and asked her and her family to accompany them to the mountain. The Watanabes were driven up to Mitsumine and, with the help of guides, taken to the bodies. Shizuka looked down at the lifeless form of the young man. Japanese newspapers ran the sensational story. Mitsuhiro Watanabe, one of Japan's most wanted men, was dead. He and a woman, probably a lover, had killed themselves. Chapter 37. Twisted Ropes. Louis knew nothing of the death of the bird. When the bodies were found on Mount Mitsumine, he was in Hollywood, falling to pieces. He was drinking heavily, slipping in and out of flashbacks, screaming and clawing through nightmares, lashing out in fury at random moments. Murdering the bird had become his secret, fevered obsession, and he had given his life over to it. In a gym near his apartment, he spent hours slamming his hatred into a punching bag, preparing his body for the confrontation that he believed would save him. He walked around every day with murder in his head. Throughout 1947 and 1948, Louis jumped headlong into scheme after scheme to raise the money to get back to Japan. When Cynthia's brother Rick visited, he found Louis encircled by fawners and hangers-on, all trying to exploit him. One of them talked Louis into investing $7,000 in a plan to purchase and resell earth-moving equipment in the Philippines, promising to double his money. Louis signed the check, and that was the last he saw of either the investor or his money. He formed a Tahitian passenger boat company in partnership, but creditors took the boat. A deal to found a movie production company in Egypt met a similar end. He even considered working as a mercenary bombardier in an attempted coup in a small Caribbean country, and was still thinking it over when the coup was called off. He and a partner made a verbal agreement with Mexican officials, giving them sole authority to issue fishing licenses to Americans. As his partner drove down to ink the deal, a truck hit him head-on, and the deal died with him. Each time Louis got some money together, it was lost in another failed venture, and his return to Japan had to be put off still longer. Drinking granted him a space of time in which to let it all go. Slowly, inexorably, he'd gone from drinking because he wanted it to drinking because he needed it. In the daytime, he kept sober, but in the evenings, as the prospect of sleep and nightmares loomed, he was overcome by the need. His addiction was soon so consuming that when he and Cynthia went to Florida to visit her family, he insisted on bringing home so much liquor that he had to take out his Chevy's back seat to fit it all in. He had become someone he didn't recognize. One night at a bar on Sunset Boulevard, he parked himself on a stool, drank all evening, and wound up stinking drunk. A man passed behind him, ushering his date past. Louis swung around, reached out, and groped the woman's bottom. The next thing Louis knew, he was on his feet outside, being half-carried by a friend. His jaw was thumping with pain, and his friend was chewing him out. He slowly came to understand that the woman's boyfriend had knocked him unconscious. On another night, he left Cynthia at home and went to a restaurant in Hollywood with two friends from his running days. Sometime in the early evening, after drinking what he would remember as only a single beer, he felt oddly light and excused himself to step outside. Then time broke into disconnected segments. He was in his car, driving, with no idea where he was or how he'd gotten there. He wove through the streets, disoriented, and came into a hilly neighborhood of mansions and broad lawns. His head spun round and round. He stopped the car and rolled out. There was a tree in front of him, and he relieved himself against it. When he turned back for his car, he couldn't find it. He stumbled along in a soupy darkness and mental fog, searching in vain for something familiar. He walked all night long, scared, lost, and vainly grasping at lucidity. As sunrise lit up his surroundings, he realized that he was standing in front of his apartment building. Opening the door, he saw Cynthia, frantic with worry. He toppled into bed. When he woke up and dressed, he had no memory of the night before and couldn't understand why the heels of his new shoes were worn down. He went outside and looked around, but he couldn't find his car, so he called the police and reported it stolen. 2 days later, the police called to tell him that they'd found the car in a wealthy neighborhood in the Hollywood Hills. He went up to where they had found it, and memories of his night came back to him, carrying the ethereal quality of a nightmare. Cynthia pleaded with Louis to stop drinking. It did no good. The further Louis fell, the less he could hide it. Rick Applewhite noticed that he was manically germophobic, washing his hands over and over again, and each time scouring the faucet and handles on the sink. Some of Louis's friends spoke to him about his drinking, but their words had no impact. When Peyton Jordan saw Louis, he recognized that he was in trouble, but couldn't get him to talk about it. Pete, too, was worried about Louis, but knew only of his financial woes. He had no idea that Louis had slid into alcoholism, or that he had hatched a wild scheme to kill a man. Cynthia was distraught over what her husband had become. In public, his behavior was frightening and embarrassing. In private, he was often prickly and harsh with her. She did her best to soothe him, to no avail. Once, while Louis was out, she painted their dreary kitchen with elaborate illustrations of vines and animals, hoping to surprise him. He didn't notice. Wounded and worried, Cynthia couldn't bring Louis back. Her pain became anger, and she and Louis had bitter fights. She slapped him and threw dishes at him. He grabbed her so forcefully that he left her bruised. Once he came home to find that she had run through a room, hurling everything breakable onto the floor. While Cynthia cooked dinner during a party on a friend's docked yacht, Louis was so snide to her, right in front of their friends, that she walked off the boat. He chased her down and grabbed her by the neck. She slapped his face, and he let her go. She fled to his parents' house, and he went home alone. Cynthia eventually came back, and the two struggled on together. His money gone, Louis had to tap a friend for a $1,000 loan, staking his Chevy convertible as collateral. The money ran out. Another investment foundered, the loan came due, and Louis had to turn over his keys. When Louis was a small child, he had tripped and fallen on a flight of stairs while hurrying to school. He had gotten up, only to stumble and fall a second time, then a third. He had risen, convinced that God himself was tripping him. Now the same thought dwelt in him. God, he believed, was toying with him. When he heard preaching on the radio, he angrily turned it off. He forbade Cynthia from going to church. In the spring of 1948, Cynthia told Louis that she was pregnant. Louis was excited, but the prospect of more responsibility filled him with guilt and despair. In London that summer, Sweden's Henry Eriksson won the Olympic gold medal in the 1500 meters. In Hollywood, Louis drank ever harder. No one could reach Louis because he had never really come home. In prison camp, he'd been beaten into dehumanized obedience to a world order in which the bird was absolute sovereign, and it was under this world order that he still lived. The bird had taken his dignity and left him feeling humiliated, ashamed, and powerless, and Louis believed that only the bird could restore him by suffering and dying in the grip of his hands. A once singularly hopeful man now believed that his only hope lay in murder. The paradox of vengefulness is that it makes men dependent upon those who have harmed them, believing that their release from pain will come only when they make their tormentors suffer. In seeking the bird's death to free himself, Louis had chained himself, once again, to his tyrant. During the war, the bird had been unwilling to let go of Louis. After the war, Louis was unable to let go of the bird. One night in late 1948, Louis lay in bed with Cynthia beside him. He descended into a dream, and the bird rose up over him. The belt unfurled, and Louis felt the buckle cracking into his head, pain like lightning over his temple. Around and around the belt whirled, lashing Louis's skull. Louis raised his hands to the bird's throat, his hands clenching around it. Now Louis was on top of the bird, and the two thrashed. There was a scream. Perhaps Louis's, perhaps the bird's. Louis fought on, trying to crush the life out of the bird. Then everything began to alter. Louis, on his knees, with the bird under him, looked down. The bird's shape shifted. Louis was straddling Cynthia's chest, his hands locked around her neck. Through her closing throat, she was screaming. Louis was strangling his pregnant wife. He let go and leapt off Cynthia. She recoiled, gasping, crying out. He sat in the dark beside her, horrified, his nightclothes heavy with sweat. The sheets were twisted into ropes around him. Little Cynthia Zamperini, nicknamed Sissy, was born 2 weeks after Christmas. Louis was so enraptured that he wouldn't let anyone else hold her and did all the diapering himself. But she couldn't cleave him from alcoholism or his murderous obsession. In the sleepless stress of caring for a newborn, Louis and Cynthia fought constantly and furiously. When Cynthia's mother came to help, she wept at the sight of the apartment. Louis drank without restraint. One day, Cynthia came home to find Louis gripping a squalling Sissy in his hands, shaking her. With a shriek, she pulled the baby away. Appalled at himself, Louis went on bender after bender. Cynthia had had enough. She called her father, and he sent her the money to go back to Miami Beach. She decided to file for divorce. Cynthia packed her things, took the baby, and walked out. Louis was alone. All he had left was his alcohol and his resentment. The emotion that, Jean Amaury would write, nails every one of us onto the cross of his ruined past. On the other side of the world, early one evening in the fading days of 1948, Shizuka Watanabe sat on the lower floor of a two-story restaurant in Tokyo's Shinjuku district. Outside, the street was lively with shoppers and diners. Shizuka faced the door, watching the blur of faces drifting past. It was there that she saw him. Just outside the door, gazing in at her amid the passers-by, was her dead son. Chapter 38, A Beckoning Whistle. For Shizuka Watanabe, the moment when she saw her son must have answered a desperate hope. 2 years earlier, she'd been driven up a mountain to see a dead man who looked just like Mutsuhiro. Everyone, even her relatives, had believed it was he, and the newspapers had announced Mutsuhiro's suicide. But Shizuka had felt a trace of doubt. Perhaps she'd registered the same sensation that Louise Zamperini had felt when Louis was missing, a maternal murmur that told her that her son was still alive. She apparently said nothing of her doubts in public, but in secret, she clung to a promise that Mutsuhiro had made when he had last seen her in Tokyo in the summer of 46. On October 1, 1948, at 7 p.m., he'd try to meet her at a restaurant in the Shinjuku district of Tokyo. While she waited for that day, others began to question whether Mutsuhiro was really dead. Someone looked up the serial number on his army sidearm and found that it was different from that of the gun found beside the body. Mutsuhiro could easily have used another weapon, but an examination of the body had also found some features that seemed different from those of the fugitive. The detectives couldn't rule out Watanabe as the dead man, but they couldn't confirm definitively that it was he. The search for him resumed, and the police descended again on the Watanabes. Tailed almost everywhere she went, her mail searched, her friends and family interrogated, Shizuka endured intense scrutiny for 2 years. When October 1, 1948 came, she went to the restaurant, apparently eluding her pursuers. There was her son, a living ghost. The sight of him brought as much fear as joy. She knew that in appearing in public, standing in full view of crowds of people who had surely all heard of the manhunt for him, he was taking a huge risk. She spoke to him for only a few minutes, standing very close to him, trying to restrain the excitement in her voice. Mutsuhiro, his face grave, questioned her about the police's tactics. He told her nothing about where he was living or what he was doing. Concerned that they would attract attention, mother and son decided to part. Mutsuhiro said, that he'd see her again in 2 years, then slipped out the door. The police didn't know of the meeting and continued to stalk Shizuka and her children. Everyone who visited them was tailed and investigated. Each time Shizuka ran errands, detectives trailed behind her. After she left each business, they went in to question those who had dealt with her. Shizuka was frequently interrogated, but she answered questions about her son's whereabouts by referring to the suicides on Mount Mitsumine. More than a year passed. Shizuka heard nothing from her son, and the detectives found nothing. Everywhere there were rumors about his fate. In one, he had fled across the China Sea and disappeared in Manchuria. One had him shot by American GIs. Another had him being struck and killed by a train after an American soldier tied him to the track. But the most persistent stories ended in his suicide, by gunshot, by harakiri in front of the emperor's palace, by a leap into a volcano. For nearly everyone who had known him, there was only one plausible conclusion to draw from the failure of the massive search. Whether Shizuka believed these rumors is unknown, but in his last meeting with her, Mutsuhiro had given her one very troubling clue. "I will meet you in 2 years," he had said, "if I am alive." In the second week of September 1949, an angular young man climbed down from a transcontinental train and stepped into Los Angeles. His remarkably tall blonde hair fluttered on the summit of a remarkably tall head, which in turn topped a remarkably tall body. He had a direct gaze, a stern jawline, and a southern sway in his voice, the product of a childhood spent on a North Carolina dairy farm. His name was Billy Graham. At 31, Graham was the youngest college president in America, manning the helm at Northwestern Schools, a small Christian Bible school, liberal arts college, and seminary in Minneapolis. He was also the vice president of Youth for Christ International, an evangelical organization. He'd been crisscrossing the world for years, plugging his faith. The results had been mixed. His last campaign in the Pennsylvania coal town of Altoona had met with heckling, meager attendance, and a hollering, deranged choir member who had had to be thrown out of his services, only to return repeatedly like a fly to spill jelly. So much coal dust had billowed through the town that Graham had left it with his eyes burning and bloodshot. That September, in a vacant parking lot on the corner of Washington Boulevard and Hill Street in Los Angeles, Graham and his small team threw up a 480-foot-long circus tent, set out 6,500 folding chairs, poured down acres of sawdust, hammered together a stage the size of a fairly spacious backyard, and stood an enormous replica of an open Bible in front of it. They held a press conference to announce a 3-week campaign to bring Los Angelinos to Christ. Not a single newspaper story followed. At first, Graham preached to a half-empty tent, but his blunt, emphatic sermons got people talking. By October 16th, the day on which he had intended to close the campaign, attendance was high and growing. Graham and his team decided to keep it going. Then, newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst reportedly issued a 2-word order to his editors: "Puff Graham." Overnight, Graham had adoring press coverage and 10,000 people packing into his tent every night. Organizers expanded the tent and piled in several thousand more chairs, but it was still so overcrowded that hundreds of people had to stand in the street, straining to hear Graham over the traffic. Film moguls, seeing leading man material, offered Graham a movie contract. Graham burst out laughing and told them he wouldn't do it for $1 million a month. In a city that wasn't bashful about sinning, Graham had kicked off a religious revival. Louis knew nothing of Graham. 4 years after returning from the war, he was still in the Hollywood apartment, lost in alcohol and plans to murder the bird. Cynthia had returned from Florida, but was staying only until she could arrange a divorce. The two lived on in grim coexistence, each one out of answers. One day that October, Cynthia and Louis were walking down a hallway in their building when a new tenant and his girlfriend came out of an apartment. The two couples began chatting, and it was at first a pleasant conversation. Then the man mentioned that an evangelist named Billy Graham was preaching downtown. Louis turned abruptly and walked away. Cynthia stayed in the hall, listening to the neighbor. When she returned to the apartment, she told Louis that she wanted him to take her to hear Graham speak. Louis refused. Cynthia went alone, She came home a light. She found Louis and told him that she wasn't going to divorce him. The news filled Louis with relief. But when Cynthia said that she'd experienced a religious awakening, he was appalled.